everybody. Welcome to the Open Mic Comedy Podcast. I'm your host, Mark. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. This podcast is for people on the open mic comedy circuit, whether you're a comedian, an MC, a promoter, a tutor, anybody who has any involvement in this industry. Even comedy fans who really do enjoy spending the time in the pub basements watching the possible stars of the future. If you're thinking, I could do that, then this podcast will give you the inside track on what to expect on this crazy circuit. Today's guest is a regular on the London Open Mic circuit, a writer, an ex-comic shop worker, and a film fanatic of the highest order. If you're a regular listener, you may have heard him already promoting a charity event in aid of the St. Pancras Community Association. So can you please welcome to the stage today's guest, Mr. Matt Zittra. Hello.
I like the little claps and stuff. It's nice to feel welcome onto the stage. I wonder if it like affects my lizard brain, my comedy lizard brain. When I hear the applause, I just want to go straight into my material.
Well, what happens when you hear this noise?
I want to throw myself off a fucking bridge. Or are we allowed to swear? Sorry, I just dropped an F-bomb within
minutes. We can.
Yeah. Oh God. Seconds. Yeah, we'll get onto my views on gong shows. Yeah, as soon as we get to that section. But yeah, I don't like that sound at all. No.
Fair enough. How are you doing anyway?
I'm all right. Yeah, I'm some guy. Some of us do this. I'm having a week off gigs.
Okay.
Because I had a couple last week, but I sort of 2 weeks blended into one. I did a Sunday and then was on yep. a Monday and then on the Friday. And yep. I need to be gigging lots, but sometimes I'll just take a week off just to recalibrate and be regular Matt for a bit. But I'm doing well, yeah.
Yeah. Good. So what is your background then in comedy? Why and how and when and all of that jazz?
So I started just shy of 2 years ago now. And, okay. Well, that's proper comedy. So my first ever stand-up experience was about 20 years ago when I was, I think I was 19. That'd be 21 okay. years ago if I was 19. And I got up and I found an open mic. I think it was above what's now Belushi's in Camden. And
right.
I got up with like poorly planned material and just sort of didn't, I essentially bombed. But I left it for ages because I was just being a bit of an edgelord. It was all stuff about pornography and it wasn't good. It wasn't good at all.
Yeah.
And then fast forward to about 4 or 5 years ago. And I'd thought about for years, like I used to work with Nathaniel Metcalf, whose comic has been going about 15, 16 years. He has a podcast with Nick Helm. He's been all over. He's very, very funny. Yeah. Like he's contemporary with people like James Acaster and stuff. So I remember seeing James right at the beginning of his career. And annoyingly, he was okay. still fantastic at the beginning of his career. Not annoyingly, he was very funny. But anyway, so it's sort of, I always felt like it. And I was always sort of funny within a group and all that. And then I did a speech at my old school. And I mean, I had a good lead up. I had two very dry speeches before me. And then I just killed yeah. the room. I'd written this speech and it had done very well. And someone said to me, my mate Mark said to me, oh, you've got to try stand-up. And then I ummed and ahed. And then I've got a friend called Josh Howie, who's been a comic for about 20 years. He's been on telly and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he very kindly sat me down for a couple of hours and just sort of tutored me on
yeah.
comedy, and he gave me a list of things that would help and all that, told me a couple of books to get, which I haven't read. And then he, yeah, I know, it's terrible. I buy these books and they just sit on the shelf. I'm not very good at studying. But anyway, so Josh pointed me towards Downstairs at the King's Head.
Yeah.
And I did my first gig there and I wow. haven't really looked back. And, you know, no one's first gig kills. No one. It's like Dave Chappelle. He says, "Oh, my first gig, I killed," and I find it. I mean, he is a very funny comic.
Yeah.
But no one does, like, in your mind, you might be, "Oh, I killed. I did okay." I think if I watch the video back now, I'd probably be a bit sick. But it went quite well. I'd stack the audience with, I had about half a dozen friends with me. And my dad was there, who's been very supportive. And it's quite funny because in my first set, I had a really disgusting joke about doing a sexual thing with my wife. Essentially, the setup of it was like, "Oh no, I have a very loving and supportive relationship built on trust and honesty. And once a month, if I've been good, she'll let me shit on her chest while I wank off onto a Furby." And I don't do that joke anymore because it's a bit much. But my dad came up to me afterwards and he goes, "Is she all right with you doing those jokes?" And firstly, she's heard them all because she's the one I was bouncing off. And secondly, we don't actually do that. Like, I don't actually get shat on and masturbate onto a talking toy. I get shat on and I masturbate onto a cuddly Elmo, like most people.
I imagine a reaction from a family member who suddenly thinks, "What?"
Yeah, I mean,
it's when he comes to you and says, "How do I get your mother to do that?"
Oh, God. Oh, if my IBS wasn't bad anyway, it's worse now. No, I kind of funny thing about the mention in the family member thing. So I've got this new bit of material that the first time I tried it, I didn't say it was about me, despite it being a totally true story about me. I said it was about a friend.
Yeah.
And it didn't hit properly. It didn't hit how it should. And the reason I said it was about a friend is because it might... I didn't want to upset my dad. It's sort of involving him. But then I did it at Too Far last Monday, where I said it was about me, and I prefaced it by saying how wonderful my parents were. And it absolutely just killed the room. Everyone was in absolute hysterics in this story. And the thing about it was it allowed me to tie it back to one of my other jokes. So it ends on a really good joke. It's sort of the last component of the tight five. So if my dad sees it, we'll probably listen to this and go, "What's the gag?" He's probably going to put his head in his hands a bit, but it's not that bad. But it's such a good bit. I can't not use it now. If it hadn't been killed... I'd probably consider leaving it out, but it's so good and it ties back so well. So,
it's always nice to, if you're kind of a storyteller, isn't it? If you can tie things up at the end and, you know, you bring everything back round to where it started and stuff like that. And there's almost no chat or part of it that's not finalized as such.
Mm.
And you that kind of closure on a story.
Yeah, it's funny because I was just listening to Stacey, who is fantastic, on your podcast.
Yeah.
And it's funny, she said something about flowing out of you, and it was, I decided to do this bit because I remembered this story from, you know, my personal history. And as I'm doing it, I realised, because I can't remember if I did I do the Olivia Colman bit when you saw me?
I don't think so.
So anyway, I do this bit sort of early on in my five where I talk about Wonka and I say, do you know how you can tell that Wonka was shot in the United Kingdom? Because Olivia Colman's in it and you legally have to have Olivia Colman in any film in the UK. And then I say...
Yeah, you're right. I remember now.
Yeah, and then the follow-up to that is... It's so strict that I was making a sex tape with my wife and 20 minutes in, Olivia Colman came in and offered me a cup of tea. So that Olivia Colman gag, I managed to put on the end of, like, as I call back to it at the end of this new block of material. And because they've sort of got it in the back of their mind, I made that joke because the Olivia Colman joke is evergreen. Everyone seems to quite like it. because everyone knows who she is. So when I come back to it, they remember before and they feel clever and they think I'm clever. So it was, that was kind of, it's only recently, I'd say, the proper type five solidified with this bit of material. So hopefully my dad doesn't excommunicate me when he hears it.
So how many gigs have you done now then over the last 2 years?
I've sort of lost count. It's funny when you... I'm almost like the anti Stacey. Stacey's like, I love organization. Yeah. And like, I am piss poor at most things. If I didn't have a calendar on my phone, I'd be useless at anything.
Yeah.
My wife had to sort of train me to actually be organized. So I stopped counting, but I've done some like maths on it. And I think I'm past the 100 mark. Just by working out the thing. So I'm 100 plus gigs.
Okay. Cool.
So
I guess you've alluded to quite a nice moment on stage where things have started to click together. So is that the best moment you've had, or has there been other far more memorable moments that you want to tell a story about? Well,
it's funny. So I'd say... The thing is, you only really remember your last good one. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure there's been amazing.
Yeah.
So I did Too Far on Monday, Richard's night. Great night. Runs to time. If anyone's listening who's not a comic or wants to become a comic, you'll start to realise that the nights that run to time that actually finish on time and everyone's times are kept, so you're not there all night, not because you're not enjoying it, just as time is money. Too Far, Richard's night is very good. Lollipops is also very good for that. Actually, so is Comedy Rehab, but a lot of them are good. But anyway, so Monday night, I've done Comedy Rehab the day before, and Comedy Rehab's usually quite a fun, energetic room, and it was a bit flatter than usual, but still did okay. But then I went on Monday, and everything just clicked into place. The gig just flowed. Everyone was laughing, and I felt I had control of the room. You know that feeling where you're like, no, I've got this. And my wife was with me, and it's annoying. Usually I get her to film, and I went, you don't have to film this one. And, of course, it's a fantastic one that would have been great online. Probably my most memorable would be my Edinburgh gig, my first and only so far Edinburgh gig, which is also my first paid gig. That was last summer. Aaron Levine, who's a more experienced comic than I think he's been going a lot longer than either of us, I think he's got an agent and everything.
I met him last week, actually.
He's a lovely, lovely man. He's doing my favourite film podcast, which I think you should do as well. Aaron and I met before downstairs at King's Head. I got there ridiculously early, and so had he. And we were just chatting about comics and stuff, and as in, like, comic books, and just chatting away and, you know, sort of being Jewish. And he went, I'm doing this thing this year that I've done before called Jew-O-Rama. We need where you have a night and it's two Jewish comics and one Gentile. Do you want to be one of the Jewish comics? And I was like, yeah. I mean, it was like a fiver pay, but it doesn't matter when it's your first one. And I had studied in Edinburgh. I went to Queen Margaret. I did film and media, which is why I'm unemployed. And I hadn't been back to Edinburgh in something like 17 years. So what was it? I made a joke about it where I said, the length of time I've been away from Edinburgh, legally I'd be allowed to fuck it, but morally it's a bit of a grey area. So I called it the Philip Schofield paradox. I did. So it was quite, it was my first time back because, you know, I'd left Edinburgh finishing uni and I'd had a breakup while I was up there. So it was weird not going. It was weird going back, and I hadn't. And it sort of actively stayed away, but in that time, in that 17 years, you know, I'd got married, and I'd had kids, and so I never got a chance. So I went up with my wife and kids. We flew up the night before the gig, which, I mean, it was a pretty traumatic journey. We're driving to Stansted, and I've got IBS, which I will say repeatedly because it's horrible. It's also why I'm smoking on this, which is totally legal marijuana. I found out I can get because of my IBS. I said to my wife, "Was pulling into the car park. I'm like, you have to let me out now. I need the toilet. My stomach's just doing flips. It's probably the nerves. And I think I shit myself before I got on the plane. I literally had to buy all new bottoms for her. So it all would be memorable. But anyway, I got to Edinburgh. We saw Max Normand. Do you know Max Normand? Tall, very, very tall guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Very character type of crazy out there comedy.
Like, he's one of the guys on the circuit. And anyone listening who knows me, I don't not think this about you. But Max is someone who I wouldn't be surprised to see go places. You know, when you sort of get a feeling of someone, his show was magnificent.
Yep.
But anyway, so we saw Max Normand's show, and then I did my gig, and like my best friend from uni was there. My dad was there again. My wife was there. And it was a very special moment for me because it's sort of like, it's not like I made it, but it's like a milestone on the journey.
Yes.
I think Aaron said to me, he wants me back this year, which is great. And I think, but yeah, it meant a lot. That gig. Sorry, I've rabbited on about that.
No, it's they're the sort of things that you have to remember, because my next question is going to be your worst moments on stage.
Well, this is an easy one. It was Beat the Blackout. I did it maybe 6 months in. Well, no, I can work it out actually. So I started about 10 months in. I did it, and I sit in a funny place in the comedy world because I'm almost 41. I'm a white cis man, and this sort of only interesting bit is that I'm Jewish. Now, anyone listening, this is not me complaining about wokeness. This is not me complaining about diversity. I think they're amazing. I'm just recognizing my place within the comedy world in 2024. And also, I'm very storytelling based. Mm-hmm. Like, my jokes are usually, you know, I'll start gag, but then I'll get into funny stories because that's kind of where I find the funny, or like silly moments. Yeah, but it's mainly more. Yeah. I'm not a one liner guy.
Yep.
So anyway, I wanted to try a gong show, and my friend actually is a bouncer there, so he got me on the list for a particular night. I got to choose. We don't usually get to choose, which is very nice of him to sort out for me. And I ended up doing it. It will be a year ago very soon. It was Easter. It was the Thursday before Easter Friday. So everyone in there had the day off the next day. So there was like 350 very drunk people in Greenwich.
Oh,
and the guys who had the cards were obviously leery. They obviously weren't up for people getting through. Mm-hmm. And I think they did get changed in the second half, which I think you mentioned in another podcast. So anyway, I got up.
Yeah.
And I got sure-footed, unfooted straight away. Like, I got up and my first joke has been the same for a while because, again, it's one of my favourite speeches works every time. My first joke is, "Hi everyone, I'm Matt Zitron, a little bit about me. I'm half Jewish and half Catholic, which in all honesty is a bit shit because I get all of the guilt but none of the bacon." And that's usually quite a good way to start off, and then I do another gag. But I went, "I'm half Jewish and half Catholic." And this woman went, "Wow!" in the front row. Really sorry, I scared my dog. and it threw me off. It threw me off my rhythm.
Yeah.
And then from then, it just went downhill. And then I used to do a joke where I talked about, "Do you know why Kit Kat Chunky is my favourite chocolate bar? And it's not the thick, veiny shaft of chocolate you get to deep throat." And then I would do the joke and explain why. But anyway, I said chocolate get deep throat, and all the men in the audience, and especially one of the guys with the cards, went, "Ugh!" because I was making a joke about sucking dick. And instead of pivoting away, I went, come on, everyone, it's Easter. You get two in a box. You can do it two ways. And it was just, even though I'm a straight man, it was too much for the audience. And I got gonged off. But like in my head, I'd done terribly. And then my mate had actually recorded it. And I was getting consistent laughs. It was just the audience wasn't with me. And you know, it is my fault, ultimately. But that one shook me. Like, I properly had a do I want to do this anymore moment. And I'm not a fan of competitions per se, just because, like I said before, I don't actually think me winning a proper competition, I don't think I'm the right person to win it. Not because I don't think I'm funny, but it shouldn't really be a 40-year-old white dude winning these things now. If I'm going to find a path through and get to a point where I can make a living from this, God willing, probably won't because it's so fucking hard. But people like me shouldn't be winning these things. And that isn't an oh, woe is me. That's a reality of what these things represent. Now, if it was like a over 40s competition, then slightly different. But even then, I think a woman should really win that, just for, you know, I'm sure people would be like, it should be the best person for the job. And it's a bit like, actually, in comedy, these competitions are so hard to get your winner, because by the time you whittle it down, everyone's good. It's just who's having the best night or run of nights, you know?
Yeah.
Competitions and stuff, I don't particularly enjoy, because I don't do this for that. I'm not like super competitive. So yeah, I've avoided Gong Show since. I probably will go back at some point, but I don't.
Yeah,
they're not designed for comics like me, essentially.
No, we have very similar, a similar take on what we do at our comedy in terms of being storytellers and stuff. And I've got to the point now where I try not to do multiple gigs on consecutive days. So I try not to do a Wednesday, a Thursday, a Tuesday, a Wednesday, stuff like that, because I'm traveling in from outside of London, as I said loads of times. So I need to kind of keep a lid on what I can, can't do. So when I plan my gigs for the month ahead, I'll always try and get a spot on a Wednesday night or a Thursday night somewhere. So then when I get that email from Beat the Blackout on a Thursday morning saying, we've got a couple of dropouts, do you want to come on? I can ignore it comfortably and I don't get tempted.
I have...
It sounds bad.
But do you know, I just want to say, like, Up the Creek is obviously an incredible club. And like
it's an amazing venue.
One of the goats, and like the I think I had Andrew Menchak, if I'm saying your name wrong, Andrew, I'm sorry, as the MC that night, and he was brilliant. Andrew Mensah. Yeah. There was a guy, funnily enough, it was the one of the fellas who went on to win the Blackout that night, who totally deserved it, very funny. There was a couple of drunk idiots at the back who were like fake laughing when someone was trying to do their set. And the guy got through, and then Andrew came out and he went and he just eviscerated them. And then he went, and I'm born and bred West London. So obviously I've heard a lot of Pat over the years. But Andrew went, "Yeah, pussy all." And it just took me back to when I was a kid and hearing people say that. But it was, it's a great club. The Blackout, if I do it again. Or like, for example, Max Norman was so good and he got gonged off. And it's like, you know, what's going on?
Yeah. No, I do. Yeah, I keep saying to myself, I'll go back again at some point. I just don't know when that point is. I'm not rushing for it. There may be a point in the future where I have like a run of 5 or 6 gigs that I think are going well, and I've got some material that I think is quite tight, and then I might go, fuck it, let's try it. But until I get to that point, I'm sticking well away from that.
Yes.
I don't think I can take another January that I had this in 2024 where I thought, I'm not sure this is for me anymore.
Yeah.
that's demoralizing.
It's exactly what it... I mean, I'm like a medicated depressive. I take citalopram, and obviously the weed is medicating as well. And I have to watch the situations I'm put in, because obviously I'm tough enough to take bad audience, well, like bad audience reaction. You know, I've had tough gigs, that sort of thing. But I don't want to put myself in these situations where I don't have the foundation of confidence in the five. Like, now is probably a really good time because I have this foundation of confidence. But again, it might not suit Beat the Blackout. And I think Daniel Ruiz Tizon said to me once, because the thing is, the audiences at these things are, they're antagonistic. They almost want to get people off. So sometimes, always it's an uphill battle. So yeah, I don't like them. I will do them again, but not for a while.
So let's go back to the positive. So the Edinburgh show, what's the actual, you said it was, what's the duo concept of it? Was it like a bounce off?
No, it's so explain all, that. It was kind of just a short bill. And we each had, 10 or 15? I think it was a 10. We each did 10 minutes. It was free fringe. And there was two Jewish comedians, and I can't remember the name of the other comics, but they were good. One of them was like pro, been going for years, a musical comic. We each did a show. What was good is our comedy was different enough that it sort of worked. And obviously there was an MC for all of it, so there was essentially four of us. But it was fun, and it's, you know, my Jewish identity is something that I only really started to connect with when I got married, because my dad is Jewish, but my mum isn't. And we were raised with no religion.
Oh, okay, that's the opposite.
We were sort of, but I am signed up by the Bet Din, which is like the religious Jew police. My rabbi is going to kill me when he hears this. Traditionally, way back, it used to be the dad size, but obviously because you can't guarantee the dad with a mum, if you get my meaning, why it's from the thing is you can guarantee the lineage if it's the child's come from a mum. That's why people say.
Oh,
that it's
okay,
from
I see.
I've explained that very badly. Good thing I'm not going to listen back to this. Not because I don't like the podcast, but I don't want to hear myself. Ew. I was talking to someone recently, because you know I present a podcast, and I realised that I'm like that bit. Have you seen Old School? You know, the Will Ferrell movie.
No, I haven't seen that Will Ferrell film.
So, well, in the movie, it's a fantastic. It's one of my favourite comedy movies. It's about a guy who recently breaks up with his girlfriend because he finds out she's like a sex addict. And he moves into a house that's actually within the grounds of a university. So he makes his own frat house with his like guys in their late 30s and all the losers from the college. And there's one bit, it's amazing, it's so good. The lead, it's Luke Wilson, Will Ferrell and Vince Vaughn. Jeremy Piven is the bad guy. I mean, it's easily one of my favourite comedies. And recently my son, who is 13, I showed it to him and he loved it, which meant a lot because I like it. But anyway, in Old School, there's a bit where towards the end, they have to do a series of challenges to not be kicked out of the school. Spoiler alert. But they do this. There's one of them's a debate. And what happens is the dean is trying to kick him out. So he gets this guy who's like, if you're in America, you'd recognize him as a political correspondent, who's like renowned for being the best at these sort of debates. And what happens is he's about to speak, and then Will Ferrell goes, do you mind if I take this? And then he gives the most wonderful, erudite explanation that's like perfection. And then he just sort of breathes out and goes, I blacked out, what happened? Like he'd lost himself. And that's how I feel like when I'm on podcasts. Like I'll talk a load of shit, even when I've not been smoking. And it will just completely leave my head. Everything I've said. Oh, and so I was like, I really liked it when you did this. I'm like, I just can't remember doing it. But anyway, Jewish identity. So it was kind of nice that was. So I've been with my wife 17 years, in fact, and but married 15 or almost.
Okay.
And she's Jewish, and she's she's like proper Jewish. She's half Israeli. Thanks for all the angry messages I'm going to get for mentioning Israel. And I just know they're coming. She's born there. And so I connected with my Jewish heritage. And then, like, when my kids were born, we did blessings and stuff. And we're sort of Judeo-agnostics, as in, like, it's about the culture and not about necessarily the religious side. And my son's just had his bar mitzvah, so I'm feeling super Jewish. But anyway, it was nice that the fact that I'd connected with this sort of heritage and side of myself and side of the family, that my first paid gig was because I'm Jewish.
And,
you know, I pulled it into that. And it was cool. It was at Whistle Binkies, which is like a cool venue that's been in Edinburgh for fucking ages. And again, it's somewhere I'd been back in the day. So it all felt very... No, it was an exceptionally special gig. And like, I was thinking of going to a late night open spot that night, but I was too busy having dinner, enjoying myself. So I think I think when I go back, if I do Judorama this year again, I'm actually going to organise myself and get booked, because now I know more people anyway.
Yeah. No, I am. Anyone seen me knows that I'm Jewish as well, but I class myself as a not the Jew kind of thing, because I am, but I'm not, in that I've never followed anything. I've never had any of the ceremonies. I know nothing other than the downstairs part, but that's it. And that's the only identifying thing.
That's the funny thing is I've not had the downstairs part. So technically I'm an undercover Jew. it's especially given, I mean, depends when you're listening to this, but especially given the tension over there at the moment and all the horrible stuff that's going on here because of all that and stuff. And I'm not going to get into the politics because it's a thorny ground that's not for this.
No,
but it's given me a certain amount of comfort knowing there's a community there. And, like, you know, my son is openly gay, and you know, our synagogue has I think two of the four rabbis are gay, a lesbian and a gay man. The head rabbi there is a gay man, so it's all very open and brilliant and, like, supportive. And it's been it's definitely been wonderful and you know, a fun thing to pick up on with the comedy. I don't go too far in it. I think if I ever did a gig in the States, New York, I'd go hard on it. Or I do intend to do a gig in Tel Aviv when things calm down, because obviously I've got a connection to the country, but they do English comedy there. And then it'd be me mainly moaning about my own people. But I don't put too much of it in, but you know, you can't see because this is an audio medium, but I have a massive Star of David and Chai, which means lives or life, tattooed on my arm. So I'm very open about it. And I think it's helped having that.
Yeah, I kind of bought it into the set really because of, I don't know why I did. I wanted a way to get into... I guess I'm rambling on, but I'm trying to build a set that includes my parents in it, but I haven't got to the point of introducing them yet. So I'm kind of looking at the background and what I am as a person and what kind of some of the things, not so much that defines me, but some of the things that people, when they look at me, what they see. Mm. And it kind of tries to go sort of deepish, but not too deep in a weird kind of way, because I actually did a gig once, which was not that long ago, and I was doing the MC for the night, and one of the acts walked in with a friend, and I was just welcoming people into the venue and stuff, saying hi, you know, oh, you're so and so, blah blah blah, and her friend came up to me and said, yeah, you really look like David Baddiel, you know. And I'm just like, yeah, I know. It's part of the routine.
I mean, and I think
I just thought to myself, go on.
I was going to say, your curse, say, is because you mentioned Baddiel, he's so entwined with Jewishness
that,
you know, it almost goes against the grain not to mention it.
Yeah, it's I kind of then... the routine kind of happened because I tried to start, I don't know if distancing myself from it is the right way, but is try to explain, yes, I know exactly what I look like. I know exactly who I'm compared to. But that's not me. And it's just a bit of a weird thing. And it made me cultivate a couple of little jokes into the start of the set that worked quite well. But I'm still trying to build something that don't really know where I'm going with it yet. And it's very difficult, and trying to pick out little parts of what I see and what I do and how it can flow. But yeah, all part of the writing and creating process.
So one of the best bits of advice I got was, have you done Downstairs at the King's Head?
Yeah, I did it last Thursday. And that's where I met Aaron.
Ah, right. That's where I met Aaron. So Georgie, who is in the booth, she's lovely. And mm-hmm. even though I don't do the Kit Kat Chunky gag anymore, I still bring her a chocolate bar every time because I started doing it. And it's kind of like the Mrs. Maisel thing. But she's lovely. But
yep.
I guess about a year ago, she said to me, Matt, I really like you, but it doesn't feel like you on stage. What I took from that was, and she was really apologetic, but I was at the time, I was like, no, this is brilliant. And it was a brilliant bit of advice. That sort of authenticity of who you are is quite important. It's got to be your voice when you're performing. And I think the one problem with that is sometimes you can over self-identify. You know, you'll have people who, you know, like Jewish comics whose only thing is that they're Jewish, or the same with Muslim or Christian, or, gay performers who it's just, I'm gay. Again, you are gay and that's part of your identity, but don't make your whole act, your whole 5, 10, whatever, just that, because the audience start to lose interest in it. And you can sort of, what you want to do is present everything you present, be it talking about the tube, but through your lens. So you're still there, but you don't necessarily have to go, it reminds a bit of, have you seen Pop Star Never Stop, Never Stopping, Andy Samberg movie?
No.
It's brilliant. It's like a fake music. It's a mockumentary about this guy called Connor For Real, who's essentially Justin Bieber. And he's like an ignorant idiot. It's amazing. It's got loads of massive cameos, but there's a song he does to try and get like publicity called Equal Rights. And it's taking the piss out of that Macklemore song. And he literally, every second word is not gay. So he's talking about equal rights, but he keeps reminding him that he's not gay. And it's very funny because it gets more and more ludicrous as it goes on. But it is sort of a bit like that. You have to present a comedy authenticity that's not overly performed, but not overly chatty. It's that weird middle place.
Yeah.
And I think every comic in their early few years, which I count myself amongst, they're trying to get that sweet spot. And there are the people that are doing the best on the circuit now in this amateur or semi-pro are the guys who have gone, that's who I am, and here it is. And it's a lot harder to do than I think anyone coming into it realizes. It takes a long time and a lot of practice. That's the only thing, is practice.
Yeah, that is the a friend of mine is taking a step into actually starting doing comedy. He's signed up for one of these charity kind of the white collar boxing but comedy version.
Yeah.
And he's asking me for some advice last night, and it's just like, right, there's certain things that you won't understand until you do it, in that you need to practice, and you need to practice religiously, but you need to practice in an environment you're comfortable with as well. So there's no point in, like, I'm not very comfortable practicing at home when people are around. I can't do it. It just doesn't sit with me. Because some of the people in this household have very different sense of humours to me. So they can be, no, I don't like that, no, I don't like that. But then I'm catering to what they like rather than what I want to do. if what I want to do doesn't work, then okay, I come back to the drawing board and I change it again. But I try and explain to my mate is that if you don't feel comfortable at home, go and find a space to go and do it. Because no matter how much practice you do running through your head, it's always perfect. But when you're trying to say the words out loud, it's such a different thing. And you don't realize it until you start doing it. You're thinking, how did I get that was so perfect when I went over it and over it and over it and over it. And then you said it out loud and you stumbled on a couple of words and you end up messing it up and you kind of go wrong. And it's what happened to me actually last night was that when I did Too Far Comedy and I got on stage and I first thing I did was I said, oh, just a big cheer for Richard for organising the night. So I was getting people on side and a bit happier and stuff. And I put a notepad down, and I don't do this generally, but I wanted to try some new stuff and kind of just do little mini sections. And I said, you'll notice, I meant to say something along the lines of, you'll notice there's a notepad here. That's my version of throwing shit against the wall. But I stumbled the words, and you've lost the impact straight away. And you've lost that. You then look like a complete amateur.
But what I think is
vocally getting the words out is so important.
But in a situation like that, I've done it many times. I think we've all done it many times where you stumbled over the words and it's how you win them back. And I think the temptation is to go straight back into the joke. But actually what I often do with that situation is I take the piss out of myself. Like, so the amount of, I've done it and I've gone, that joke would have worked brilliantly if I'd said it in English and then everyone laughs at that. Or like... Or something like that. And then you can almost save the fact that you fucked up. Because everyone, I think, unless it's a gong show, people don't want you to fuck up. They want to have a good time. And I think if mistakes are part of life, and I think you can, it's how you rebound. I think the night, it might have been the night we met, I did, it was Comedy Rehab. Shout out to Dave Goodman. And my last joke. Tune. Yeah, brilliant. And I won it last time, but he didn't have the mug, so I'll get another time. I've won it before. That was, I was doing my last gag, which I don't use anymore because it was like a sort of gag, which was any party you go to can be a gender reveal party if you just drop your trousers as you come in the room. Now, the way I did the setup was my niece, who has now given birth, my niece who was born in 2001, I was saying, oh, she's pregnant with her first child. Now, what I ended up saying was my niece who was born in 2016. I said the year two, and I stopped and everyone was like, what's going on? And then I sort of explained that because I fucked up the year, this next joke, and then sort of then went on a riff about she was at an orgy, we don't know who the father is, and everyone was dying with laughter because even though I'd fucked it up, I brought it back. And I said, they were all watching Bluey and it all kicked off. And they went, that's a true Bluey. And then I finished the joke and it was a bit like, oh, I managed to sort of dig myself out of that hole. But there's been times where I've just gone, but I don't want to be, some comics do this thing, and again, no criticism, but I don't do it myself, which is where they say, oh, you didn't like that one, or that didn't work. I don't like calling attention to it that way. But sort of putting it on yourself and going, what? You know, trying to get in with them is a better way.
So a nice question to delve into is that we've spoken kind of a bit about joke writing as such, but what is your either favourite or best joke? How did it start? And... has it changed over time?
So there's sort of two answers to this. I said earlier my you know, double header of half Jewish, half Catholic, and then the undercover Jew joke. It started with just half Jewish and half Catholic, and then I ended with the undercover Jew joke that sort of was quite a nice finish up. And I have sometimes done a little add-on, like I've said, you know, like most white middle-aged men who like hip-hop, I like to pretend that I'm in the hood, as in, it's another thing, it doesn't always hit. What's annoying is probably my favorite joke I've ever written that comics love, but the audiences don't, and it is too wordy. I do this thing, funnily enough, about my IBS, where I say, "Oh my, I've got IBS," or as I like to call it, Russian poulet. Whatever I eat, be it quaver or quinoa, I could just have diarrhea at any time. And then I say, I just want to say that calling it Russian poulet is not racist, because Russian isn't a race. Though, if there was a Russian race, I imagine there'd be a doping scandal where one in six would blow your head off. And it's a clever joke with many layers. I love it, but it's funny enough, I'm writing my longer show at the moment, and it's something that I might be able to put in there, but it's not something for a 5-minute set where people aren't sort of tuned in. It's a bit too wordy. But that is hands down my favourite joke I've ever written.
So has it always stayed that way, or did parts of it kind of get added on as such?
I think it grew. I think I just came up with the term Russian poulette, and then it became the sort of twinning back to Russia and, you know, doping scandal, and then back to Russian roulette. So it just started as the funny term Russian poulette, and then it sort of metastasized into the larger joke. But I don't do it anymore, but it's in the bank for the longer show.
Yeah, I think we've all got some of those. I don't know about you yourself, but I've kind of got 2 5-minute sets that I've deliberately broken down into sections, so I can actually remove one section from one five and put it into the other five. And it doesn't feel like it's too out of place. It's still along a similar theme, but it caters for something slightly different.
Yes. A modular five is how all of us should be doing it, really, is because not every night, the same material won't work every night. And you can sometimes, I've done it myself, I've been on stage going in with 1-5, but I end up performing a different one. Because you read the room and you can tell what's working and what's not. Again, because you want to be trying, the temptation when you're on the open circuit is to try new stuff all the time. But there comes that point where you need to go, oh no, I need to work. You need to sort of break in a five like a horse. Once you've sort of got your components, you need to just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And then every so often you might try something new, but you need to say to yourself, no, I need to work this. I recognize this has worth as a bunch of material. But right now, I need to just thoroughbred this in. That's not the correct term. I don't know why I said that. It's because of horses. Nay.
I was wondering where he was going with horses.
Well, breaking in a horse works because the idea of the horse is wild. And you've got to then break it in so it performs how you want. And that's what I meant by that. But then thoroughbred came in out of nowhere. So I apologise to any horse owners listening.
No, I think it's very true. I think I've come to learn this just in the last week, is that you, especially if you don't perform multiple times a week, trying to refine that one thing once a week that you can do it, or twice a week, is the way to go. Don't keep trying to change things. Make that five as best it can be. If you know you get laughs, if you know you get in that 5 minutes, if you're averaging a laugh every, I don't know, 30 to 45 seconds, try to change it so you get that extra laugh every 20 to 30 seconds or something like that. Try to improve it and see where it can go and make it better.
Yeah,
but and it'll give you the ability to play.
Yes, you don't want to overstuff though, because it sometimes you can overwork a joke, and sometimes a well placed silence or a funny face works better than any writing.
Yeah, and I guess that's the one thing you'll never know unless you practice in front of an audience, because you don't know. This is another piece of advice that I've given to my friend, is that 5 minutes doesn't sound like a lot of time, but when you, if you're the sort of person that likes to tell a story, 5 minutes is never enough time. And 5 minutes in reality is pretty much one A4 piece of paper in note form rather than fully written out. So understanding where the pauses are going to happen and try to work that out. And you're only ever going to get that by practice.
Mm. Yeah, I started just practicing with my wife and sometimes the kids, and then I was gigging. And now I do very little practice that's not live. Do you know what I mean? Now it's almost like I do it in the trenches because I've been going long enough that I've got that. I have a feel for five in my head, which you get after a while. Yeah. Like when you've done a lot of fives, you sort of know in your head how you're keeping to time. But yeah, it is at that beginning. It's just repetition.
Yeah. And just knowing everything back to front. And when you become that bit more experienced, you can then dip in and out of your set. And when you come back, you know where you are because you know it.
Yes. But it's also fun to riff as well. Like I like doing MCing because when I MC, I'll do a bit of material. But actually, MC is the best place to get your crowd work and thinking quickly on your feet. I mean, I've always been quite good at coming up with things on the fly. Like I've never done improv, but I'd love to because I think I'd be quite good at it. But MCing very much will work that muscle as well. And it makes you a better comic, even if you don't do that often. So that when you're in that 5 minutes, if something doesn't go right or something does go right and you come up with writing while you're going, it's such a good feeling. It's like, you know, a three-pointer in basketball. Is that three? Yeah, three-pointer.
Yeah. So where have you MC'd then?
I've done Lollipops quite a few times. I've done compulsive comedy. I'm trying to think if there's anywhere else. I did Comedy Cat in Ealing. I sort of jumped in for the second half for that because Glyn wasn't feeling well and had to go. And the guy who he'd asked to MC the second half didn't want to do it. So I hopped in and did it.
Okay. No, I enjoyed my... I've done MCing once. I loved it. I had the... It felt like the pressure was off because I knew that if I was doing a bit that wasn't going well, I can just introduce the next act. Yeah. You've got that kind of freedom to go, okay, and I'm sure this person's going to be a lot better than what you just heard over the last 30 seconds, so please, welcome to the stage. Da-da-da-da.
And then they smash it apart and you go,
great, perfect.
Yeah. You can make a joke of that if you're having a uphill. MC is like essentially you're taking them on the journey and along the way you're showing them the delights of other comics. And you can have a lot of fun with that. I was thinking back because I was coming on this. Now, I think it was Chris Ford, who's a fantastic comic on the circuit, but I was emceeing at Lollipops and I think it was him. Chris, if I got this wrong, I apologize, but I think Chris was a Jehovah's Witness or he was raised a Jehovah's Witness. Whoever it was, they were raised a Jehovah's Witness, right? And I went, oh, Jehovah's Witness, that's weird. You can't accept blood, can you? And he went, no, and we can't have organs unless they're empty of blood. And on the fly, I just went, so how do they get them in? Do they sort of have them like a flat Capri Sun and they just sort of inflate them with their mouths as they go in? And it was just like such a fun observation. And and again, it's one of my favourite moments of MCing was coming up with stuff like that. And again, you could try your material, but sometime, it's another skill, bringing in your material without making it seem like I'm just going to do my stuff first. Do you know what I mean? You can weave it in and, you know, again, it's another skill that makes you a better comic.
Yeah. I used it as an opportunity when I've got lots of little 30-second to 1 minute bits that I wanted to try out that don't fit in the five or the seven that I've got. And I wanted to know if there was any legs in them and if it's worth developing. So I would do a couple of them at the start, the odd one thrown in the middle between an act if it allowed it to, if it felt like a place I could fit something in, and then do my normal, I do probably like three or four of my normal five at the start of the second half whilst everyone's getting themselves back together after getting another drink and kind of getting their seats and relaxing into it. and then introduce a couple more bits. But you're always trying to look for what the person before that's just come off the stage, what they've done, and how you can either bring the audience up or bring them down to a level that's needed for the next person, and just have a laugh with what's going on. Because the first person I introduced, I said this before, is she was a 17-year-old girl, and it was her first ever proper gig, and she wanted to go first. And I was just like, balls to her, you know, go for it. So she went for it, and she smashed it out of the park. And I kind of gone on stage and just gone, how old do I feel? Just introduce somebody 30 years younger than me. And I think she's better than me already.
But there are people.
It has a bit of fun to it and stuff.
I don't punch down ever. Like if I pick on people, it will be, I don't pick on people. Well, I have picked on people in the audience, but it's only, the only time I've done it is when they're talking during the set, which I think you're fair game then. If someone's having a chat while you're trying to perform, they're welcoming it. So I try and keep it nice. So if I have a comic who's maybe bombed or not done that well, I don't labour the point that they've not done well. I don't sort of go, you know, well done. Da, da, da. And I might say, this is tough to people. I might say, you know, getting up there is very hard and all that. But it is tough when you're in your 40s, because obviously at our level, there's lots of young people doing comedy. And there are times when you see someone who is 20 years your junior and you're like, oh, fuck off. And you've got your youth.
Yeah, she was 30 years my junior.
Oh.
And you're just like, I guess it's a generational thing, in that people my age didn't really grow up. You didn't have the outwardness that people have these days that they've had with social media, and the comfortableness of putting themselves out there on a forum, whether it's a YouTube video, a TikTok clip, or an Instagram reel, or something like that. I didn't have any of that. Whereas a lot of these younger people, you know, I guess there's, I don't know if you found it having like younger kids. My kids have kind of just kind of bypassed that bit. But when it comes to asking, what do you want to be when you grow up? A common answer supposedly in schools nowadays is a YouTuber. Because they see what's out there.
We're comics, so we obviously all wanted to be fucking TV presenters.
I wanted to be an accountant.
Jesus. I don't know what I wanted to be. I think writer was what I wanted to be. It's an interesting thing, Big, and I'm not saying, neither of us are old. We're sort of at the first point where you go, I'm not young. But there is a whole sort of generational discourse that we're not part of. So, you know, I've been married for almost 15 years. So I've not done Bumble, Tinder, all that stuff. So all these dating apps.
I had the same conversation with somebody else.
It bypasses me. And, you know, the stuff like the ick and terminology that, I mean, I understand because I've had to learn it. But, you know, you get up on stage and I worry when I see an audience predominantly in their 20s, I feel like I'm a bit on the back foot, because my experience and their experience is very different. So it has to be, that's why I've tailored my thing to the way it is. And that's what I've had to learn to do, because I realized that when you're a little bit older, your experience is so different. And actually, one of my things, this whole bit about my dad is about photographs. And part of the joke is that you had to have them developed, which for people like us, it's like, oh, that's obvious. But people in their 20s, they don't necessarily think like that.
No.
So, again, I'm not moaning per se, but it's something I have to be aware of in my stuff. Because, again, it's like sometimes I can be talking about stuff and I have to remind the audience that, you know, I talk about making a sex tape with my wife. And I, the other day I was making it, and I had to one point go, you realize this was so consensual? Like, and like, because we live in that world, and I'm glad we live in that world, and I'm glad that we are in totality like a more accepting world and all that.
Yeah.
And that, I'm glad that my trouble, not really trouble, but my whole journey is that I have to be aware of who I am and how I come in. Because the worst thing is, like, there was a joke. How did I exactly put it? I had a gag, and I had to preface it by saying, I did a whole bit about Epstein Island. That's awful joke, horrible joke. And the sort of point I make is that I'm a white cis man, and we live in a world of diversity and kindness, and you don't pick on people and all that. And I'm not complaining about that. I'm not like, I look like I could be like, and you won't. I'm not like that at all. Lifelong champagne socialist. But what I say is I build it up, and I say we live in a better world. And then I say, but I'm a comedian existing in a world where there's a chance that Dr. Stephen Hawking was at an orgy, which, let's face it, is fucking hilarious. The idea of this horny Roomba bumbling around an orgy. And again, sometimes that goes down really well. Some audiences don't like it. I totally understand why. It is an awful thing, and I don't actually do the joke much anymore. But again, it's something like that where I've had to, I can't just go into that joke because I've come across as a complete arsehole. And there are some male comics who sort of lean into that, but that's not who I am. Yeah. So I'm almost like the white guilt. I mean, it's quite fun because, like, with my son being gay, I'm working on a bit about how he recognises my white guilt to the point that he's used it to get out of things. That, you know, I'll tell him off and he'll be like, oh, I'm gay, you can't say that. And I'm like, which he actually does do, little fucker. But again, there's all that joke. And again, the preface has to be that I'm not just mocking my son for his homosexuality. I'm laughing at the situation that he sees me, you know, he sees that white guilt. So it is. And like, some of the best jokes are, I think my favourite kind of humour is where you go very close to the line. You don't cross it. So it sounds like you're going to say something fucking horrendous, but you don't. And I think that's what I'm trying to get the right line with the material about my son being gay.
Yeah, I guess it's... I experimented at the MC with a joke about Epstein's Island, and it actually went down quite well. And I tried it last night, and it went flat as hell. It's just like... Okay,
you have to have...
Yeah. Okay, let's we're probably going to end up parking that because it's losing its relevancy. It's got a short shelf life in terms of, and you can't build on that and rely on that in 12 months' time. Because my focus again was similar to yours on Stephen Hawking. My brain went down that route because it's so bizarre.
I think the annoying thing for me is James, and I'm going to get his surname off the internet because I've forgotten your surname, James. Sorry. I did the Hawking thing and it went really well. And then James got up and he did an even better joke. And it's one of those jokes that's like, oh, I wish I'd written that. I've forgotten it now because I'm old. James Osei, Osei, very funny black comedian.
Oh, yes.
Young guy, but he's very funny. He does a whole thing about white girl bangers. I think he might have been on the night we were on. There's a whole thing about white girl bangers, as in music that's like typically for young white women that you like. And he's very, very good at that. Very funny comic. But he made a joke and I was like, ah, you've just topped me. You've built off what I've done by bringing it up. It is the Epstein stuff. I think I did it early on because it was in the news, then stopped. And then when all the Stephen Hawking stuff came out, I sort of milked it for all it's worth and then realized there's not much fun in it. I kind of have like a short version of it and then move away where I mention about my IBS and I say it's an ongoing thing where you're not quite sure where the pain's going to be, but when it does, it sort of explodes, a bit like how the royal family view Prince Andrew. And then I would say, say what you will about Epstein's Island, hell of a kids club. And what's annoying is I came up with a really good punchline. Again, this is going back to the overly wordy. I fucked it up a couple of times and then finally got it. I said, what's the weirdest thing about the whole Stephen Hawking's at Epstein Island situation is that it proves that the island of a sex trafficking paedophile was wheelchair accessible before most of the London Underground.
Yeah.
And it's quite a good punchline if I say it properly, but again, it's too wordy. But yeah, it is. There's topical. I try not to be topical because it dates you really quickly. And again,
I've got some topical bits in there where I can just change a politician's name so it becomes, it still remains topical and stuff like that. So I've got a bit of a caveat of that. But a friend of mine, he came up with an Epstein one that I thought it was absolute genius. He kind of painted the picture about Epstein's list and all of this lot. And he said, could you imagine walking into the room? You've got like Michael Jackson there doing a moonwalk. You've got Rolf Harris painting in the corner. You've got David Copperfield doing jokes. And you've got Stephen Hawking in the car park doing donuts. And I was just crying because it didn't go to the sexual place. It just put this image in your head. And you just, and when he said Hawking doing in the car park doing donuts,
that's amazing.
I was gone.
I also used to reel off the list, but like add names to it. So I'd be like, yeah. So I'm not saying any of these people necessarily took part in paedophilia, but you know, there was Bill Gates, Bill Clinton, David Copperfield. And then I stop and I go, Barry Scott from the Silip Bang ads, Elmo. And then I do my Elmo impression. And it's just adding to the stupidity. Again, as a father, as two fathers, there is a part of me that think, oh God, we're awful joking about sex trafficking and paedophilia. But again, it's stuff I've left behind because actually it's so divisive that I don't know if I want that to be part of my comedy all the time. I don't want to get a name of the guy who always makes that sort of joke. I'd rather have some of my stuff is gross out, but I'd rather it be more like, oh, for fuck's sake, than paedophilia.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I think it's one of those things, if you try to be like a fairly clean comedian, you start looking at some of the darker and stuff that other people come up with, and you take a bit of admiration in that, in how they can say it and how they can get that across and how it becomes funny. But you know in yourself that if you try to do that, you're not going to do it as well as that other person.
Well, and it's I'd never describe myself as a clean comic. Definitely not. But I do get what you say. There are jokes that I look at. Again, I know I keep harping on about being a white man and it's not like I've got a complex, but it's about, you know, because in this world, the best part of it are mixed bills, that you've got lots of different jokes, different comedians from different backgrounds doing gags. And you sort of experience the funny from different lenses. And the amount of time I've seen a comic of colour or a comic who's gay or a comic who's a woman who's made a joke that I would love to be able to tell, but I can't because of who I am, and that's fine. I mean, I could. It'd just be awful. There is a jealousy. It's funny enough, I showed my son Ted last night, the live action, you know, the Mark Wahlberg movie. What's his name? Peter Griffin. Seth MacFarlane. And it's not dated well. There's a lot of sort of, oh, that's gay stuff in there, and some of it runs the line of like some of its offensive jokes is just so out there that you kind of go, and sometimes it's a bit like, which I think is Seth MacFarlane's whole shtick, that some of his stuff hits, some of it doesn't, but he just does so much. But there was one joke in it that was horrible, but the way it was done worked. So there's a bit where Mark Wahlberg's walking home after having an argument with his partner, Mila Kunis, and she drives up next to him and says, come on, get in the car. And he goes, listen, if I'm raped, it's my fault because of what I'm wearing. And it's a great gag because it's not necessarily making light. It's more like it's swapping the situation. And again, that joke, that sort of joke, I could deliver a joke of that ilk, but it has to be careful how it's pitched, because essentially you've got to be like holding up a mirror to the ridiculous a little bit, not going, oh yeah, I won't get raped. So it's that, because, you know, obviously there are places for white men to do that sort of anti-woke comedy, but apart from the fact is I don't believe any of it. I don't find it funny. If I did anything that was sort of like anti-woke, it'd probably be from the other side, laughing at people who were getting upset about it. Like, you know, the whole thing about like, I wanted to write a bit, and again, it hasn't coalesced in the way I want, about I don't understand why parents have problems with their, especially dads have problems with their son being gay. Is it like, are you upset that you can't eye up their partner like you could fuck them or something like that? Like, it's like, what is the issue? Do you know, you shouldn't be involved in your kid's sex life. Chill the fuck out. And again, I need to get it in that place where it's more laughing at people, but it's not virtue signaling. It's not me going, oh no, great for having a gay son. It's like, no, I just want it to be matter of fact, it's just the stupidity behind it. But I suppose that's kind of why I love doing this, because it's about that word economy, and it's about construction in a way that the words that are coming out of your mouth when you're a comic also relate to the person on stage. So you could say something that is on paper very funny, but if you say it as the person you are, it won't work. You have to get it in a way that people will accept it coming out of your mouth.
I completely agree. So if you were to become super famous one day and you get the chance to be walking out in front of 5,000 people at Hammersmith Apollo and you get to choose your walk on music, what is it?
This is really easy for me. It is Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, Spanish Flea. He spent Eurotrash quite a lot. It's become like a comedy bit of music that's like permeated my life. That my wife said to me, you are not to play at our wedding. And of course I did play at our wedding. And then I wasn't allowed to play at the bar mitzvah. They actually like locked me down. They had to give me Hadaway, What Is Love, just to distract me. But yeah, definitely that, because it sort of reflects the stupidity of me. Like, my whole thing is, it's just silly. I'm a silly man. And that song is just fun and silly. And also it's got a clap in it that I like.
Okay. Yeah. And then you just hope the audience do the clap at the right time, or you encourage them to do the clap at the right time.
But again, if I am the only one clapping, that's a gag in of itself. I live not far from the Hammersmith Apollo, so I'd love to get that just for the ease of it.
Yeah, one day, you never know.
Yeah, never know. One day. Here's hoping.
So if we go back to the open mic circuit itself, what's the one thing you'd like, if you could only pick one thing to change about it, what would it be?
I think I would get rid of overstuffed bills. I think one of the biggest problems of the circuit is promoters putting on too many acts, and then these nights running so long that the audience, by the time, because we all hate going last or going late in the second half or even the third section. And I think, I don't think nights should overdo it. They shouldn't overstay their welcome, because it won't help the night grow, and it won't help the comics, because I did a gig recently where I was so late in, I'd almost lost enthusiasm for my own set. Because I've waited through it. We've all done that. Do you know what I mean? You've waited and you've waited and you've waited. But also you can see the tiredness on the audience. So I probably would change that. And that is as long as they're mixed bills. I think having the same sort of acts on bills is death as well. I think a nice mix of men, women, whatever gender you are, whatever sexual persuasion, but people who do different styles of comedy.
Yeah. No. Succinct, and yeah, I agree. I agree. I think some nights would benefit from, if you got somebody that's doing one night and they cram the bill, if they could do two nights but the same number of acts spread across two nights, I think you might get more people there.
Yeah, and I'm not, just want to make clear to any promoters listening, I'm not singling out anyone for doing this.
No.
I've been to nights that have been super full and have gone gangbusters, and I've been to nights that are good length and haven't. It's just, it's one of my pet peeves.
Yeah, I think there's the, especially if you are of the bringer status, then it's not just the comic that's got to get home, it's the bringers that have got to get home as well. And if you're keeping them there till 7 o'clock in at night and they've got to get home and get to work the next day, that person's probably not going to come again.
Yeah.
So you've lost the bringer and lost an audience member.
But we all want everyone there, be it the promoter, be it the comic, we want all people we've not brought to remember us and and know that both the night is good and the comic is good. And the more comics you have, the less memory space there is. But also people get tired.
Yes. I completely agree. Completely agree. So if you, a friend of yours came to you and saying, I'm thinking about starting this, starting doing stand-up comedy, what's the one piece of advice you'd give them?
Don't. No, that isn't what I'd say.
Josh, there's too many of us already.
No. Are you funny? If they're not funny, yeah, do it. If they're hilarious, no, I don't look at it like that. There are lots and lots of comedians a lot funnier than me in the circuit, and I love and support my brothers and sisters. Josh gave me one of the best bits of advice, which was write down every sentence you're going to say in your set and put a star at the end where there would be a laugh. If you've written it all down and there's not enough stars, you need to refine it.
Yeah.
And it's a way of breaking down a set, a 5 or 10 or a 20 or 30, where you can see your journey, you can see where the laughs are, because you recognize. And it's something I see quite a lot of comics do, but is it puts on the back foot, is that you need to get a joke in quickly. You need to get that first laugh in. And sometimes comics take too long to get to that first gag. And this is a good exercise about doing it and about keeping the flow. And, you know, sometimes you might end up having a setup that's a bit longer. But again, that wouldn't be at the beginning. And it helps you understand how to word things and how jokes work. And you can only get better at viewing it, because after a while, I mean, I don't actually long form much anymore. I have, like everyone, I've got notes in my phone, and then sometimes I'll write it out longer in the phone. But I don't actually, I used to write out my sets every time. I don't do that anymore because I've been going long enough that I know it and I know what I'm doing. I think when I do a longer form show, which is the plan for 2025, I will. But when you're starting out, writing out of it just makes you understand the craft better.
You're right. It's also, I think there is people, when people talk about the setups, there's no reason a setup can't have jokes along the way. So if you can wheedle something in there, if your setup is, I don't know, 35 seconds long, if you can get a joke at 25 seconds, it keeps people interested for that full 35 seconds, because you made them laugh in between, even with just a small titter about something. And their brains then trying to guess what the next thing's going to be. And when that next thing is not what you've got in your head, you've then got a bigger laugh at the end of it. So use the setups wisely.
And it doesn't even need to be like a big laugh. It can almost be like a smile setting up for a laugh. So with the half Jewish, half Catholic joke, sometimes I start it, or most times I start by saying a little bit about me, now we're all friends, and people sort of titter or smile at that because they feel brought in. And again, that's a way just to get a quick smile, so it means that when the punch of the unexpected, I get all of the guilt but none of the bacon, they're already ready. You're almost going, there's a joke coming now, and you're going to like it. And then they go on. Yeah. And it's that exercise really shows you how it is. Like, because you the concept of something being funny, you do need to almost study it in front of you on a bit of paper to be able to get good at doing it. You can be all of us have been known as funny at some point in our life. That's yep. what we do. But it's about understanding how to shoot that funny at people.
Yeah, no, completely. So regular listeners will know that we spoke probably about when this goes out, about 6 weeks ago ish or 6 weeks ago. You did a charity event that we promoted on here.
Thank you very much.
What was the outcome?
It went really well. Funnily enough, while we've been on this, I've got a notification from the charity on Insta who are saying thank you. Yeah, it went well. It wasn't like a night set up like we're used to. It was almost like it was a communication with chairs, but the audience were fun. All the acts were brilliant. The charity was happy. And they told me on the night that we've essentially covered their operating for a whole month just with that gig. Cool. Yeah. And I think they might do it again in the autumn. So I hope they have me back, but it was good fun and everyone was in a good mood. And I didn't have any curry because of my tum tum, but everyone who had it said it was delicious. But I mean, you know, it's nice to take what we do and then do some good with it. It felt good.
Yeah.
And like, you know, but everyone was lovely. It was nice hanging out with other comics, everyone at the sort of same level.
Cool. Oh, it's good to hear. It's good to hear that these nights, and I've seen quite a few charity ones starting to crop up more and more these days. But knowing that they're actually worthwhile and the comics get something out of them and the charities actually achieve what they want to achieve, it's good to know. It's like a friendly partnership.
Yeah, I think post-COVID, comedy's on the rise because people just want to get out and do something that feels intimate. And, you know, regular open nights, be they free, you're just paying for drinks or what have you. But if you're paying a ticket to something, it's sometimes nice to know that the money's not just lining a bar's pocket. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's obviously quite tough at the moment. And I'm a very fortunate person. And I'm glad to have been able to help in some little way by being a silly bastard.
And on that note, silly bastards, we're kind of coming to the end of this conversation, but as with all previous episodes, I want to introduce the Comedian's Challenge to yourself. For new listeners, I have a book here called The Little Book of Shit Jokes by Sid Finch. And I'm challenging every comedian that comes onto this podcast to pick a joke to tell live on stage. They don't know what joke it is. They get to pick the joke, though, but they only get to pick it by a page number. And then I want them to do it live, record it, and then post it on Instagram and then add us as a collaborator. And we can all laugh at each other's ability to tell a shit joke, hopefully quite well. Because some of the ones I've seen so far have been quite funny.
I'm intrigued by what I get and what I can do with it. Stacey got quite a good joke, so I'm hoping. What's the number between? And I hope I don't pick something someone else has done.
It's not between 5 and 95.
11.
Oh, early on. All right. 11, 11, 11. Okay, you've got two jokes on this page. Would you like joke one or joke two?
Joke one.
I think you'll like it.
Yes.
The joke I'd like you to tell on stage is, Doctor, I keep dreaming that I'm drowning in an ocean of fizzy orange liquid. Don't worry, it's just a fantasy.
Oh, that'd be good. Oh, maybe I could bring in Mariah Carey's fantasy with ODB. While everyone's here, if you listen to the ODB, Old Dirty Bastard, to his friends, version of Fantasy by Mariah Carey. Apart from the fact it's mad. It's the only song where, like, at the end of it, it goes, "What are you going to do when you get out of jail? I'm going to do a remix." Surely you'd see Family if you've just got out of jail, but whatever. but right at the beginning of that, Old Dirty Bastard predicts COVID because he goes, "New York in the house, Brooklyn in the house." And he goes through a list of places. And at the end, he goes, "Everybody in the house." So obviously, he saw lockdown coming like a rap Nostradamus.
Very good. Now, it's quite interesting to see how these people, how you guys mix these jokes into a set. And feel free to adjust it however you see fit. But as long as the premise stays the same, you don't have to do a doctor. You do something. Yeah. You can do something else with it.
Oh yeah, I've already thought of something. Oh, I might make it disgusting. Brilliant. I've worked out how I'm going to do it. Good. I just want to say I was listening to Stacey. So I keep mentioning Stacey because I listened to her one this morning.
Yeah.
And I have a funny story sort of involving Stacey. That I saw Stacey first perform at Sunday Shtick, which I haven't been back to in a while, so I should do that. It's a good night. And Stacey obviously talks about her breasts quite a lot. She's a pretty lady.
Yes.
And someone, I was at another gig, and someone mentioned Stacey or something. And I went, "I think I've seen her." And they went, "The one with the boobs." And my white guilt just went, "Oh!" And then it was a woman who said, she has to go, "It's okay. You can mention about her boobs because she does all the time." And it is just that good thing. I don't want to be like, "Yes, her with the tits. Show them to me." it's like my mind was all, I was already in court being charged with being a dirty bastard. So, sorry, Stace.
No, she was there last night, actually. She was at Too Far last night, and she was at King's Head last week as well with me, so I've seen her a few times over the last
week.
That
is the funny thing about, like, you will realize if you now, I think you're probably going a while now as well, you can't do a gig without at least one person you gig with before. It just doesn't happen anymore because you've been on the circuit so long. And there is times when you feel like you're stalking someone, like Sarah Conrad and I are forever crossing paths unintentionally.
Yeah. It's always nice, though, because you know when you go somewhere, you're going to see at least one friendly face.
Yes. But I try and make pals with everyone.
Yeah. But you know you're not going to... Because I guess as much as lots of us like being on stage, there's a lot of us that are quite introverted outside of the stage.
Yes.
So you start... You're not always the most forthcoming person in a room of people that are doing nothing and going, "Hi, my name's Mark." You know, making smart. And then somebody says, "Oh, yeah, I gigged with you before." And you're like, "Oh, shit."
Yeah, I mean, the memory thing, like, I think I've now gotten to the point where I don't even feel bad if I've forgotten someone because we see so many people and everyone forgets everyone else. You remember by the material.
Yeah, as soon as you hear some of the jokes, you're like, "Oh, yeah, that's it. You've got me." But cool. Thank you for your time today, then. It's been a lot of fun, as I was expecting.
Thank you for having me. What are your socials? See, I'm a bit crap on social media because the only one I religiously use is Instagram. And there I'm just Matt Zitron, as in J-U-S-T. M-A-T-T-Z-I-T-R-O-N. Just Matt Zitron. I am on Twitter at Matt Zitron, but I don't use it that much. And Facebook is personal, so just really Instagram.
Yeah, cool. And you can find us on Instagram at Open Mic Comedy Pod. We're on the W's, openmiccomedypod.com. And whichever platform you're listening to this podcast on, a nice little review or stuff would be good. I've opened up the question and answer section on Spotify, if that's your thing. So we'll see what comes back from that. And share it with your friends, anybody you think that's interested that would benefit from something like this. And if you're a comedian who wants to appear, just drop me a DM on Instagram and we'll look at getting you on. So until next time, thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
And keep being funny on the stage, and we'll speak again soon.
bub.